Hi, good morning. I fear that Rabbi Adlerstein took away a potential topic for a future series, so we'll have to figure that out. Also, he could very well have dealt with this topic because this is actually in his field of professional expertise. Hopefully, everybody at least has a copy in English of the disputation. Those of you that are interested in a Hebrew version, the Ramban's own language, you can find it on HebrewBooks.org, you know, the free websites, and it's called Vikuach HaRamban, so you can find it. And generally, there is a two-volume Hebrew set that is called Kisvei HaRamban, edited by the late Rabbi Shavel, and there you will find the disputation, again, the Vikuach HaRamban. Today, though, I'm still not going to do the disputation, so you'll have a week to look at this. I still have introductory material. Again, if the Rambam could write an eight-perek introduction to Pirkei Avot that only has six prakim, so sometimes the Hakdamah can actually be longer than the actual Sefer itself. But the point is this. Since the Vikuach HaRamban was such an instrumental reason why the Ramban came to Eretz Yisrael, he literally would not have come to Eretz Yisrael had there not been the aftermath of the disputation at Barcelona, I do want to talk a little bit more about the Ramban's own philosophy about Eretz Yisrael, and this is a theme that permeates many of his writings. And it's important to remember, again, let me remind you, that the 13th century, there was a great revival in the idea of coming back to Eretz Yisrael. And that is why in 1211, as we mentioned, there were 300 French rabbis and scholars who came to Eretz Yisrael, settling in Akko. This was 1211. The Ramban came in 1267, in the aftermath of the disputation. And if you read a lot of the writings of the time, you will see there were very, very rigorous debates about making Aliyah, what wasn't necessarily called Aliyah then, not making Aliyah, the pros and the cons. And I want to, again, go over some points of the Ramban as well as bring in other contemporary authorities that were going back and forth about this. First, there is already a Mishnah in Maseches Ksuvos. It's a Mishnah that basically says either party to a marriage has the right to demand that the other party move to the land of Israel. So when a husband and a wife get married, if the wife wants to go to Israel, the husband is obligated to go with her. If the husband wants to make Aliyah, she is obligated to follow him because of the great spiritual importance of living in Eretz Israel. Now, this is already in the Mishnah. Now, Tosfos brings, again, the Balei HaTosfos were in France and Germany in the 12th, 13th, and 14th centuries. Tosfos brings an opinion of Rabbi Chaim HaKohen, who was a contemporary of Rav Shimshon of Shantz, or Sens. Now, again, be sure you remember the names. I had mentioned last week that in the massive, relatively massive Aliyah of the 300 rabbis in 1211, the leader was the greatest gadol in France, Rav Shimshon of Sanz. Sanz was the city in France. It's called the Rash Mishantz, as I was referred to. And he actually made Aliyah, and they indicated he wrote very definitive commentaries on the orders of Zerahim and Tyros, presumably in anticipation of his coming to Eretz Yisrael. Rav Chaim HaKohen was an older contemporary of Rav Shimshon, and Rav Chaim HaKohen writes that Bizman Hazeh, already in his time, there is no obligation to go to Eretz Yisrael, and therefore a husband cannot make such a demand on his wife, nor can the wife make a demand on her husband. And he gave two reasons for the exemption. Reason number one, sakonat hadrachim, the tremendous danger in traveling, which, by the way, is not a reason that really applies today at all. But the concept was it was a dangerous trip in terms of wild animals, pirates, robbers, bandits, disease, and therefore Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is not a commandment for which one must risk their life. This is reason number one. Reason number two is there are so many mitzvot tuluyot ba'aretz, truma, shemitah, and Rav Chaim HaKohen was a bit of a fatalist and a pessimist. He said, it's impossible to keep them right. And as a result, Rav Chaim Cohen felt it was inevitable that one would be nichshal in keeping the mitzvot tuluyot ba'aretz, and therefore, better not to put yourself in a situation where you will mess up and sin. Now, let me point out that that also has no application today, because now we have so many hashgachot, meaning to say, even if one were to assume that, oh, gee, how am I going to take truma and maser? First of all, these mitzvot are much more familiar to us than they were hundreds and hundreds of years ago. Rav Chaim Cohen is talking to a society in which the actual way to do these mitzvot was totally unknown. It was unfamiliar. That's not our milieu today. And in any case, most of us are buying food under hashgacha and the like. So neither of those reasons really apply today, but these were the two classical reasons that he gave. One was sakanat rachim, and the other was the inability to keep the mitzvot tuluyot bi'aretz. So that's one view. On the other hand, well, let me give you an extreme view. Then there's a view that was found in a letter. There was a well-known professor of Talmud at Hebrew University for many years, Rabbi Yisrael Toshma. I don't know if Toshma is his real name. Is that his real name?
No.
That was the name of the family, yeah. He was a religious person, and he was a big Talmud Chacham, in addition to being a very, very distinguished academic. And his work is of extraordinarily high quality. And he really wrote on many, many subjects regarding Talmud, including manuscript research. And he unearthed a letter from the 13th century that he ascribed to none other than Rav Yehuda HaChassid, who was one of the very, very famous pious Hasidei Ashkenaz, who wrote Sefer Hasidim. This is not Baal Shem Tov Hasidim. This is the pietistic movement in Germany. And he actually was asked by somebody, this is amazing, he was asked by somebody, would it be a good idea to move to the land of Israel to get kapara for Averot and have the great zechut of living in Eretz Yisrael? The language of this letter is, not only is it not of benefit for you to do so, it is a sin for you to do so. Because if you're going to leave your wife and children behind, which was actually relatively common, that is sinful, because you are separating from your wife and not taking care of your children. And if you bring your family here, not only will you not keep the mitzvot tuluyot bi'aretz, which is already Rav Chaim Cohen, but he says, the sins you do in Israel, in Eretz Yisrael, are much worse than any sins you're going to do in Chutz La'aretz. Therefore, if you're not going to be at Tzadik Gamor and you're going to sin, better sin in Germany and in France than to sin in Eretz Yisrael. This was a very extreme view in which Rav Yehuda HaChassid, we're not entirely sure of the attribution, but Professor Toshma thought it was Rav Yehuda HaChassid, actually said that for people who are not tzaddikim gemurim, it is an absolute sin to come to Eretz Yisrael, because if you're going to sin, do it in America, do it in England, do it in Germany. Don't profane the holiness of the land. Of course, it's reminiscent a little bit on the opposite side of a famous remark of Rav Kook. Somebody asked Rav Kook, you know, why is there so much machlokas and bitterness in the land of Israel? I mean, if they're going to have machlokas, maybe they shouldn't come here. Why is there so much machlokas here? So Rav Kook said, how come there are so many sick people in hospitals? And the answer is, the hospital, in theory at least, is where the sick people come to get better. So Rav Kook said, Eretz Yisrael is supposed to attract cantankerous and even sinful people, so to speak, because this is the process of refuat ha-nefesh, that will bring them closer to God. But again, I was just very surprised from Yehuda Chassid to see such kind of an anti-Aliyah statement based on Kedushat Ha'aretz. On the other hand, yeah. That's correct, but it's not the same. There are two Rav Yehuda HaChassid. That's 100% correct. It's a little confusing. The Rav Yehuda HaChassid I am talking about is the author of Sefer Chassidim, and that goes back to the 13th century. The Rav Yehuda HaChassid you're talking about is a later Ashkenazic leader who did indeed bring over many Ashkenazim to the land of Israel and built the show that is now known as the Chorva, which Baruch Hashem is not a Chorva anymore. Two different Rav Yehuda HaChassid separated by 400 years. Now, there is, however, much writing in the opposite way. Obviously, if 300 Rabbanim left France to come to Eretz Yisrael, there was a great, great revival of the idea of connecting to Eretz Yisrael. And as I say, Rabbeinu Shimshon of Shanz was really, really, really one of the Gedolei Hador, if not the Gadol Hador. So he put his imprimatur. In fact, this is the Tekufa where we have many interesting tshuvot about Kibud Avihem and Yish of Eretz Yisrael, where someone sent to the Maharam Rutenberg, the mayor of Rutenberg, a shaila, my father doesn't want me to come to Eretz Yisrael. He has forbidden me. Am I obligated under Kibud Avihem to obey my father? And the tshuvos in halacha generally said no, because the same way your father cannot tell you to violate the Shabbat, because Kibud Avihem is always going to be subordinate to other mitzvot, a parent cannot tell a child not to make aliyah. This, by the way, is a tshuva that is very relevant today, but please do not take it out of context. The fact that a parent doesn't have a veto by invoking Kibud Avihem doesn't mean parental needs and wishes are to be totally ignored. If a parent needs a child there, certainly for physical reasons, and even for emotional reasons, one needs to discuss it with a rav or a posek. It's not an automatic thing that you simply trample over the needs of parents. But the one thing that is clear lahalacha is that Kibud Avihem cannot be a trump card. It doesn't end, so to speak, the discussion, and that's equally true for Shiduchim. Kibud Avihem does not apply, does not give parents a veto on who you're going to marry. But that doesn't mean you ignore what your parents say. I mean, your parents, after all, might be right. Everybody remembers Mark Twain's famous statement. He said, when I was 17, I really thought my parents were so ignorant. And when I was 21, I was amazed at how smart they had gotten in only 4 years. And we discover that very, very often. So one has to understand that just because Kibud Avihem is not mechayev me to listen to my parents, that doesn't mean I shouldn't take their words with a great deal of understanding and the like. So we do find many, many tshuvot moving in the opposite way. And let me point out, this was such a live debate issue at this time, and historians are not quite sure what happened in the 13th century to create this type of interest, this type of debate, because there are centuries in which there were no significant movements to Eretz Yisrael, and then sometimes things just happening. And we still don't have a clear answer, but I just want to point out that there are three different factors in play, and different rabbis focused on different things. There was a certain aspect of messianism that was involved, and this goes back to a discussion which I cannot go into great detail right now, but if you remember in the book of Daniel, there were various calculations when the redemption is supposed to come. And these are very obscure calculations, and indeed many of the dates that the Rishonim like to give have obviously passed. But let me just say that in the 13th century, a number of these messianic dates were there. So part of the impetus of Aliyah was a belief in the imminence of Geula and Mashiach, and therefore part of it was a messianic movement. That is one component. A second component was a more of a halachic movement, and that is, of course, this is just answering a question with another question. The 13th century saw a renewed study of many aspects of halacha that had not been studied before, such as the Talmud Yerushalmi and the Seder of Zraim, agricultural laws, and purity. Now, maybe that's gufa because of the messianic impulse, maybe not. But the point was, among many, many rabbis, there was a desire to come to Eretz Yisrael for the pragmatic reason of keeping these mitzvot in ma'aseh, meaning to say they wanted to translate their learning into practical kiyum. So we might call that pragmatic Zionism, meaning it was not aliyah for messianic purposes, but was aliyah for the purpose of keeping mitzvot tuluyot yoretz. And that's the opposite of Rav Chaim HaKohen's point. Rav Chaim HaKohen's point was, mitzvot tuluyot yoretz is the reason you shouldn't go, because you're going to mess up. But there were others that were more optimistic. There was called a sefer, called Sefer HaTruma, in which Rav Baruch says, if Hashem gave us mitzvot, surely we will be able to keep them properly. And he goes through different sources where great rabbis were able to keep the mitzvot properly. And the third component was the identification of a separate mitzvah of living in Eretz Yisrael, apart from the mitzvot to Liyot Be'aretz, the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. So here, I need to specifically move to the Ramban's philosophy about all of this. And that is one of the themes that comes out of the Ramban's particularly commentary on the Torah, which he finished in Eretz Yisrael, is his great, great love for Eretz Yisrael and his sense that this is the place where one truly serves HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And I want to point to four different passages in the Ramban's commentary where he makes various points about Eretz Yisrael that are worthy to ponder. And these points are actually amplified in his Rosh Hashanah drasha, which is the drasha that he gave in Akko on his first Rosh Hashanah in Eretz Yisrael. We talked about the drashat haRabbah. First point is actually in the parsha of last week's or 2 weeks ago parsha, where the Ramban points out we read in Parshas Vayera the destruction of Sodom and Amorah. They were destroyed because of their immorality, their cruelty, their lack of compassion, their lack of sexual morality, all of the different averos of Sodom and Amorah. And actually, it was not just two cities that were destroyed, there were four cities that were destroyed. Sodom, Amorah, Adma, Utzvayim. But there was a fifth city that was already in the Egyptian border called Soar, and that is where Lot fled after the destruction of Sodom. The Ramban makes an interesting point that Sodom, he argues, was not necessarily worse than Egypt. And indeed, Egyptian culture might have been more decadent. So why was Sodom, Amorah, Adma, Utzvayim destroyed when Soar was not destroyed? So the Ramban makes the point, which Rav Yehuda HaChassid used, but not in the way the Ramban intended, that a chet in Eretz Yisrael is taken much, much more seriously. Ha'aretz eina sovelet Ovrei Aveira. This is a land that cannot bear the commission of sin, particularly sexual immorality. And that is why the Ramban says by the Arayot in Parshat Acharei Mot, when the Torah says you must obey all of these sexual laws, the language of the Torah is very vivid. V'lo saki ha'aretz eschem b'tamachem azah. The land should not vomit you out as you contaminate the land. And therefore the Ramban says the land of Israel literally gets physically sick and disgusted with sin and contamination. again, the implications for today I will leave for you to think about. But let me just remind you that the Gemara in Chulin and the Medrash Bereishis Rabbah says that one of the sins of Sodom was sodomy, right? That's where it comes, homosexual relations. But it mentions that Sodom was not destroyed because of the practice of Mishkav Zachar. Sodom was destroyed because they began to write a ketubah for Mishkav Zachar. Meaning, that this is what Chazal said. Meaning to say, it wasn't the sin that was so bad. It was the legitimation of the sin. Again, beferish, and these are, in a disheartening way, very, very, very prophetic words. Now, that is point number one. Now, Rav Yehuda HaChassid actually drew upon that reasoning, although he didn't quote the Ramban, to argue, hey, if a sin is worse here, don't bother coming. Now, that is not the Ramban's intention, as you will see from the rest of the Ramban. So, the Ramban was not using this as a reason to dissuade people from coming. Lehepech, he was using it as a reason to come and try to be righteous. That's the argument. Okay. The second point the Ramban makes, and this is especially elaborated in the Drasha to Rosh Hashanah, an amazing thing. He says, we know, of course, there's a familiar distinction between mitzvot tuluyot bi'aretz and not tuluyot bi'aretz, right? Well, everyone knows. Some mitzvot we only do here. Shemitah, Truma. But many, many mitzvot we do in chutz la'aretz. Shabbos, Kashrus, Tefillin, Tefillah. So most of us think that the spiritual distinction in mitzvot between Eretz Yisrael and chutz la'aretz only pertains to mitzvot tuluyot bi'aretz. But my davening in Chutz La'aretz is just as valuable as my davening in Eretz Yisrael. The Ramban says, not true. The Ramban makes a very startling assertion that the ultimate purpose of all mitzvahs, not just Tuluyos Be'aretz, Shabbos, Kashrus, Tefillin, is only Mekuyam in the land of Israel. And the only reason Hashem commanded us to keep mitzvot in Chutz La'aretz is that we should keep in practice so we'll remember what to do when we come to Eretz Yisrael. So again, let me be very clear. Of course you're obligated to keep mitzvot in Chutz La'aretz. Of course it's an obligation. And it's a doraisa. The Rabban is not saying it's drabanan. It's a doraisa. Hashem commanded us. But Hashem commanded us in order that we should remember what to do when we get here. But the real spiritual effect of every single mitzvah we do is only achieved in Eretz Yisrael. And the Ramban actually quotes a medrash to this effect. Hatsivi lecha tziyunim. Make for yourself a marker, a reminder, so you will know what to do, l'shetiglu, that when you are in Golos, you will remember what to do when you come back. That's an amazing statement, and the full implications are not clear to us, but the Ramban seems to say that mitzvos in Chutz La'aretz of any nature are of secondary compared to the mitzvah of Eretz Yisrael. So a davening here is much more significant than a davening somewhere else. A Shabbos here, the observance of Kashrus here. And the Ramban says, this is part of the meaning, there's a statement in the Gemara that says, anyone that lives in Eretz Yisrael, Dome is similar, Kimi Sheyeshlo Eloka. They have a God. If you live in Chutz La'aretz, you don't have a God. The Ramban says, what does that mean? HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the God of the universe, the only God. But he then develops the idea that in Chutz La'aretz, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave over the day-to-day operations to different malachim. There's the undersecretary, right, of the angel. That's the undersecretary of whatever it is, America and England and Germany and France. Now, certainly, even in Chutz La'aretz, you can try to bypass the officials, just like you can try to go to the president directly. So we certainly believe a person can have direct access to Hashem, but the norm is, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, you got to deal with the Malach. In Eretz Yisrael, HaKadosh Baruch Hu took the portfolio himself, just like a prime minister could take a certain portfolio like foreign minister. Hashem took the portfolio of Eretz Yisrael. That doesn't mean life is going to be easier here. It could be the opposite. It just means HaKadosh Baruch Hu is directly involved in your life here in a direct Hashgacha Pratis. This idea, which I know you've heard many times, but again, I want to emphasize, this is from the Ramban. This is an idea that the Ramban himself develops. A third...
Okay.
Yeah, I will be with you. Yes. Well. Again. Yeah. That can be.
That's why Jacob was hesitating. He was afraid to leave Eretz.
Well. Again, there are a lot of different reasons why you're afraid. I mean, you're afraid because you're going to be a slave. I mean, you're going to Mitzrayim had many costs besides that. But this is what the Ramban says. The Ramban says here, you are under the hashgacha of HaKadosh Baruch. In Chutz La'aretz, Hashem is supervising, of course, but the day-to-day is nimsar, it is given over to malachim and various intermediary forces. Now, because of this, the Ramban has a very interesting analysis of another question that's a very well-known question. And that is, we find Chazal had a mesorah, it's a mishnah in Maseches Kedushin, that the Avram Avinu kept the whole Torah before it was given. That he knew with Ruach HaKodesh what the Torah would say, and he kept it. He didn't have to keep it, but he kept the mitzvot ad shelo nitna, before it was even given. And although the Mishnah only says it about Avraham, but the Mefarshim seem to understand that that was also Yitzchak and Yaakov, and the Shvatim and the like, that this was a Ruach HaKodesh or a Nevuah. So one of the questions, again, there are many, many questions. This is a huge, huge discussion point in many, many Mefarshim. But one of the famous questions is, how could Yaakov marry two sisters? Rachel and Leah are sisters. Actually, some say Bilhah and Zilpah were also sisters. But L'chol HaPachot, Yaakov married two sisters. Now, it's true that the Torah permits polygamy. That didn't become forbidden until Rabbeinu Gershom for Ashkenazim. But the Torah does prohibit marrying the sister of your wife, meaning you can't marry two sisters. Huh? Well, no. Which two? No. Once a sister dies, you can marry the other one. Yeah. You can marry Achos Isha after she dies. You cannot marry Achot Isha even if you divorce one. If a person divorces his wife, he cannot marry the sister. If the woman dies, he can marry the sister. But certainly, you can't marry two sisters when they're both your wives. So how could Yaakov marry Rachel and Leah? Now, technically, you could answer, well, it was before the Torah was given, so this commandment was not binding. Well, that may be true, but if the Avos kept the whole Torah before it was given, you have a problem. So, the Ramban says the following idea. The Avot kept the whole Torah before it was given on a voluntary basis. It wasn't mandatory. They only did so when they lived in Eretz Yisrael. Because since they were in the palace of the king, they felt a special reverence and they wanted to keep the mitzvahs. Since Yaakov married Rachel and Leah when he was in Haran, that was perfectly fine. And then, in a sense, they got grandfathered in or grandmothered in when he came. But of course, the Ramban points out this might be part of the reason why Rachel died very shortly after they came to Eretz Yisrael. There are many other reasons that are given as well, but it might be once they're in Eretz Yisrael, they are living, they're supposed to live by the holiness of the Torah. Now, the Maharal of Prague, in a very, very fascinating discussion about this whole inyan, about what did the Avos keep, what did the Avos not keep, the Maharal of Prague doesn't like the Ramban's reason. The Maharal of Prague says, well, wait a second. If the Avos kept before Matan Torah, what the Jewish people are going to keep after Matan Torah, the same way the Jewish people have to keep these commandments, whether they're in Eretz Israel or not, the Avos should have done the same thing. But the truth of the matter is, based on the Ramban's own philosophy of mitzvahs, the Ramban's distinction is actually very well understood, because the intrinsic value of these mitzvahs are only in Eretz Israel. And even if Hashem made us keep them afterwards, so we'll remember, the Avos didn't feel that particular compunction. Meaning, if the mitzvahs would be the same here and there, then the Maharal's question would be a more powerful question. Right? So we see already that the Ramban is telling us about the significance of sin here is worse than sin in Chutz Laretz, the significance of mitzvah, the fact that you are in the Heichal HaMelech, in the palace of the king, what a privilege it is, what an honor it is, and at the same time, what a responsibility it is, which should give a person some thought about how we live our lives. But the final point is that the Ramban identifies living in the land of Israel as a positive mitzvah in the Torah itself. Meaning, apart from all of the spiritual benefits, there is a direct mitzvah called Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. And here I just want to elaborate on this a little bit. And that is, we know that the Rambam, Maimonides, wrote Sefer HaMitzvos. Right? This was before the Mishneh Torah. This is a relatively short work in which the Rambam enumerates the 613 mitzvahs of the Torah with a brief explanation. Sefer HaMitzvos has three parts. It's a very interesting book, actually. Part 2 and 3. Part 2 is a listing of the 248 positive commandments. Part 3 is a listing of the 365 negative commandments. Now, that already makes the book a little cumbersome, because the Rambam separates the positives and the negatives. Now, that's a little confusing sometimes, because many mitzvot are combinations of positives and negatives. So, for example, Shabbos has a negative commandment, lo sase bo melacha, do not do work. And it has a positive commandment, Zohar, and also Tishbot. But the Rambam doesn't put all the Shabbos commandments together. Some are in the positive thing, some in the negative thing. You got to flip back and forth. Okay, that's part 2 and 3. What is part 1? Part 1 is an absolutely original composition of the Rambam, where the Rambam formulated 14 principles as to how you count mitzvahs. And let me explain why that is quite a difficult and confusing problem. The problem is this. Chazal gave us a tradition that there are 613 mitzvos in the Torah. 365 thou shalt not do, and 248 thou shalt do. But they didn't give us a list. So I open up my Chumash. If I was to enumerate every time God said to do something, every time, I would not only have 613 mitzvahs, I would probably have 5,000 commandments, right? I mean, why don't you count, for example, thou shalt not eat from the Eitz Hadas. Why isn't that a mitzvah? Is that a command of God? Yes, it is. Or, if you want to go even further, v'yomer Elokim yehi or, let there be light. I guess spiritually, in Hasidic thought, you might say that that's ultimately the first and most important commandment of all. Live your life in a way that you generate light. Okay, that's beautiful. But halachically, we certainly don't count a mitzvah called Yehi Or. So what's going on here? So the Rambam actually formulated what you might call scientific criteria as to what you count, what you don't count. And basically, without going over the 14 principles, the basic idea is that the 613 are only permanent mitzvot, not temporary mitzvot that had an expiration date. So for example, not eating from the Eitz Hadas was only a one-day mitzvah. Not leaving over the mun, right? There's a commandment, When you gather your man, do not leave it over to the next morning. That is a mitzvah, but it's not one of the 613 because it is not a permanent mitzvah. Right? 613 means permanent. Or another type of rule the Rambam goes through, that when the Torah gives you a process that has many steps, we don't count each step as a mitzvah, we just count the process as a mitzvah. Example, when the Torah says when you commit a certain sins, you bring a sin offering, a korban chatas. Now if you look at Parshas Vayikra, it says, and the Kohen shall shecht it, and he shall sprinkle the blood, and he shall burn the fat, and he shall eat the meat. We don't count that as five things. There's a mitzvah, bring a chatas in accordance with the steps and procedures. Or Shabbos. There are 39 categories of work you're not allowed to do on Shabbos. So why don't I say Shabbos counts for 39 prohibitions? 39 negative commandments. The answer is no. There is only one negative commandment. Don't do malacha. What is malacha? Malacha happens to be defined in 39 different ways. Well, you understand the concept. The Rambam is trying to figure out, how do I take these 5,000 statements of Hashem and put them into 613 categories? Some of them are very subtle, and many of them there are disagreements with, etc. But this is really the first. See, the Rambam was not the first one to attempt to write listings of mitzvahs. This was done by Rav Sadia Gaon. This was done by the Hilchos Gedolos. But the Rambam was the first one who developed criteria for inclusion. People just listed things. The Rambam, as a scientist, halachic scientist, so to speak, tried to develop logical criteria. Okay, so those are the three parts of the Sefer HaMitzvot. Okay, now, the Ramban wrote, we mentioned last week, Hasagot, criticisms, disagreements on the Sefer HaMitzvot. Sometimes he disagreed with the Rambam's general rules. Other times he disagreed with the Rambam's counting of things as mitzvot. He counted them differently. Now you understand that this type of cheshbon is what you call a zero-sum game, because anytime the Ramban adds a commandment, he's going to have to take another one away because you're wedded to the number 613. Now the Rambam lists 613 commandments. Ramban thinks some of the commandments are missing. The Rambam should have added some commandments. Well, if you add, you have to subtract. So the Ramban is playing the shuffling of the chairs all over the place. But there are a number of things the Ramban adds to the Rambam's list. But the most famous and the most important is Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. In the Rambam's list, in Maimonides' list, there is no commandment called living in the land of Israel. It is not listed. Now we'll see what significance that has. It is not listed. Now, let me be very clear. In the Mishneh Torah, Maimonides certainly extols the spiritual beauty of living in Israel. No question about that. But in terms of a concrete mitzvah, thou shalt live here, the Rambam does not count it. Ramban says that is a mistake. There is a mitzvah min ha-Torah called Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. And just to be sure you don't start limiting it, the Ramban says explicitly, b'chol eis u'b'chol sha'ah, all times. It does not require a Beis HaMikdash, Ramban says. It does not require a Beis HaMikdash. It does not require a Melech. It does not even require, so to speak, a Jewish government per se. It is a mitzvah to live here. Now, where is that mitzvah derived from? Because it says in Parshas Masai, the last Parsha in Sefer Bamidbar, Virishtem Osa, Vishavtem ba. You shall inherit the land, and you shall dwell in the land. The Ramban says this was not just a commandment for that generation to go in. It's a mitzvah ledorot called Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Now, if you look at the Ramban inside, you see a very, very important thing. The Ramban says the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, this is Ramban, Nachmanides, has four separate components. There are four components in Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Component number one, this is Ramban in the Hasagos of Sefer HaMitzvahs, there is a mitzvah on the Jewish people to conquer and establish sovereignty over all land that is within the biblical boundaries of Eretz Yisrael. Which means it's not just living in Israel. According to Ramban, at least, there is a mitzvah to establish what we would say a state, a Jewish state, a mitzvah to establish a Jewish state, and the Jewish state should be as large as the Torah's boundaries of Eretz Yisrael. Suffice it to say, that is a lot bigger than the state of Israel. And the Ramban says, and if that has to be done by war, even that aggressive war, the war to conquer the territory of Eretz Yisrael, that would be Milchemet Mitzvah. Again, so according to the Ramban, it's very, very clear that establishing a state is not only permissible. According to the Ramban, establishing a Jewish state is a mitzvah. Now, again, we could argue and debate, this is not the time, what would the Ramban say about a secular state or a non-religious state? You know, we can debate all of that. And again, you know, one can make distinctions here. But the concept that a Jewish state is a good thing, the Ramban actually locates this, he situates this, as a component of the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. So that's not yet telling me where I have to live. That's really a directive to the Am Yisrael. Okay. Component number two of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is that even when the land is under Jewish sovereignty, it should not be left shemama. Shemama means desolate. The land must be put to productive use. Either residential, people live there, people cultivate it, industry. I mean, the Ramban doesn't go through every use. Now, it's true, park and recreation is also a cultivation, but it shouldn't just be barren and desolate. We still have that big Negev down there, that Ben Gurion's big dream somehow was not realized after even 70 years. We still have all of that desolation, and the Ramban would say, we should do something with it in a positive and constructive way. By the way, in this prat of the Ramban, some people say you can fulfill Yishuv Eretz Yisrael from a distance when you contribute to Jewish national funds, plant trees in Israel. They even say pick up garbage in the streets. You're making the land more miyushevet, more habitable, prettier. Again, one should never throw garbage anywhere, even in America. But echoing the Ramban, it's very, very true that to litter here is much worse. Not only because of the general idea that any aveira in Eretz Yisrael is worse, but specifically, part of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is trying to make this as beautiful a country as we're able to make it, and not to mar. Someone told me a story which was really absolutely outrageous, that a family wanted to make a picnic on Shabbos, so they had a picnic, but then they were very machmir in the laws of muktzah, so they said, well, once we have trash that's no longer usable, it's muktzah, so unfortunately we can't dispose of it. Now, you have the right to be machmir in hilchos muktzah. But if you're going to take the position that you can't
clean up after yourself, then obviously you don't make a picnic. You know, you're being machmir, and then you're being a. We saw Solanter's famous statement: you're being a tzaddik on other people's cheshbon. That you're never allowed to do. So that's the second component. So the first component is, now again, I want to emphasize this first component because it is a direct argument with the Turei Karta. Well, maybe we'll get into it a little later. That is, the Turei Karta says it is forbidden to have a state until Mashiach comes. And they have sources for that. I'm not going to deny it. The Ramban seems to say, not only is it not forbidden, it is the first component of the mitzvah d'oraisa of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. And even the 300 French rabbis did not fulfill that component because they came to Eretz Yisrael, but they were living under foreign domination. Third component of the mitzvah of Yishuv, this is all the Ramban. Third component, and this is fascinating, it would only make sense in retrospect, it is forbidden for a Jew, no matter where he lives, to consider any country in the world other than Eretz Yisrael his homeland. Meaning, even if you're living somewhere else, don't consider this the homeland of the Jewish nation. Now, what on earth is the Ramban talking about? Well, he must have had Theodor Herzl and Uganda in mind. Again, I don't want to fault Herzl. I mean, Herzl's motivation was that he wanted to get Jews away from the anti-Semitism of Europe. And at that point, if settlement in Palestine was not feasible, he was looking for an alternative. So I don't have any need to impugn his motives. But the concept that Uganda could somehow be the national home of the Jewish people, or Galveston, Texas, which is also a proposal, or the Soviet province of Georgia, right? Stalin at one point offered Georgia. He gave us Siberia, but he offered Georgia at one point. The Ramban says, no matter where you live, Eretz Yisrael has to be your home. In fact, I think Rabbi Wein tells the story. Maybe he's told you the story here, that when he was building his yeshiva in Muncie, so some contractor offered him wood from Finland, special wood from Finland, which has a life of 200 years. Most wood begins to warp after 50 or 60 years. This was 200 years. So Rabbi Wein said he will not build anything in the Galut that is supposed to last for hundreds of years, because that would be a statement that he intends to stay there. Now, I have a little bit of a kasha on that, because the Gemara tells us that the yeshivos and the Batei Medrash of Chutz La'aretz are going to be relocated here. So he could have taken the finished wood, and it's going to come here. But okay, that's a kasha. Now, the Shalach HaKadosh, who, by the way, the Shalach HaKadosh, going back to the 1500s, after the Ramban, was a great, great Rav in Frankfurt, Germany, and he came to Yerushalayim. And he wrote a big kitruk on people who build big fancy houses in Chutz La'aretz. And he said it was wrong because they're making a statement, we're here to stay. So that's the third point. Now, the fourth point of the Ramban is the only one that people cite, and that is the individualistic obligation to actually and physically live here. See, the first three don't necessarily compel where you live. Jewish sovereignty, sure, I'm in favor of it. I'll lobby AIPAC, or AIPAC will lobby Congress. And I hope that the democratic control of the House of Representatives in America is not going to hurt Israel a little bit. Unfortunately, it might. But okay, so the first obligation I can do from afar. The second obligation I can do by planting trees in JNF. And the third obligation is I'm a Zionist in my heart. Yeah, I live in America, but Israel is my home. Okay, that's all Jewish Americans that are religious at least have that attitude. But the fourth one is the immediate challenge. You have to actually, physically live here. Now again, this is not a share in all of the halacha. Even Ramban is modem that there are going to be exemptions from the mitzvah. One could not make a parnasa you know, there are going to be, in other words, a chiyuv does not mean a chiyuv no matter what, but it does mean that the default setting is there's a chiyuv, meaning a person has to have the attitude, I mean, I'm preaching obviously to the converted, a person has to have the attitude that I am chayev to live here unless I have a real good reason to be determined by halacha, and not have the attitude that it's not even on the radar. Okay? The Ramban says it is a mitzvah d'oraisa called Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. These are the four components of this mitzvah according to the Ramban. Now, the other side of the coin, though, is what is Maimonides' view? He doesn't count it. So first, do we paskin like Ramban? Some, well, again, it's hard to say. Some say we do and some say we don't, so it's difficult to know. But what is Rambam's view? So there are two different views in the Mefarshim. And strangely enough, or maybe understandably enough, the halachic interpretation somewhat is connected to your political orientation. The politics actually has somewhat of an influence on how you interpret the Rambam, Maimonides. The standard view of the Rambam is that there is no chiyuv. There is simply no chiyuv to live in the land of Israel. There is no chiyuv. It's a good thing. It's a nice thing. There are many, many benefits, etc. The Rambam would encourage it, no doubt. But it cannot be called an obligation. That is the standard understanding of the Rambam. But in the Dati Leumi community, there is a different Havana of the Rambam in which the Rambam doesn't count it, not because it's not a mitzvah, but because it's a super mitzvah. What do I mean by super mitzvah? Remember I had mentioned that in part one of Sefer HaMitzvot, the Rambam gives criteria for what you count, what you don't count? So one klal that I didn't mention is the following klal. The Rambam writes, we don't count commandments to keep the whole Torah. Now think about this. Hashem says many times in the Torah, Ushmartem es mitzvosai, keep my commandments. So, if I look at the list of the 613 commandments, why isn't there a commandment called keep my commandments? You're not going to find that. So the Rambam says, and this is a logical argument, you can't count keep my commandments as a commandment because it's not adding anything over the specific commandments. If Hashem gave you 613 commandments and then gave you a 614th statement, keep all of these things, well, keep all of these things is not adding anything to the obligation of keeping A through Z. Right? That's the Rambam's rule. Okay. So says some of the Dati Leumi, Rav Shaul Yisraeli, some of the Gedolim of the Dati Leumi world, that maybe the Rambam would agree with the Ramban that all commandments are truly fulfilled only in the land of Israel. So we don't count living in Israel as a mitzvah. It is simply the mitzvah to keep the whole Torah. Well, a mitzvah to keep the whole Torah, we'll call it a super mitzvah. It is not counted in this specific list. Which means, in other words, what that means practically is, the Rambam also says you're obligated to live here, but it doesn't count as a mitzvah on his list for technical reasons. So we actually have two polar opposite expositions of Maimonides' view. Either Maimonides says it is not a mitzvah, or Maimonides says it is such a significant mitzvah that the fulfillment of the whole Torah depends on it, therefore it is not counted as a discrete, separate mitzvah. Now, I want to point out one final point. Many say this whole debate of whether living in Israel is a mitzvah like the Ramban or not a mitzvah like the Rambam, or what's the Rambam Shita, is on some level of secondary importance. Because even if it is not a mitzvah, Chazal tell us, meaning it's not a commandment, meaning it's not an obligation. So what? Chazal tell us This is how we connect to Hashem. This creates a deepening of our relationship. There's a holiness here that you will not have anyone. Meaning to say, whether it's a chiyuv might be not besides the point, but it's not the machriya. It is not the only factor to keep in mind. However, it is true that if something is a chiyuv, you would need a stronger reason not to come than if something is not a chiyuv. Meaning, if something is not a chiyuv, there are shikulim that might be given greater weight. Now, Parnassa is a classic example. It is absolutely true that even like the Ramban, one is pater from Aliyah if one cannot make a Parnassa. But what does it mean not to make a Parnassa? If a person says, I'm not going to move to Israel unless I make as much money as I made in the United States, well, goodbye. I mean, nobody would be here at all. I mean, that's the famous result. How do you become a millionaire in Israel? Come with 2 million, you know. So obviously, Parnassa doesn't mean it has to be the same or better. Obviously, a person has to make some sacrifices, but some sacrifices meaning there's a gavul, and different people have a different breaking point. Different people are not able to function below a certain level. And these are very intangible factors. One needs to, you know, to have a rav or a spiritual advisor, one who knows them well, that they can discuss this. And children can be very vulnerable, right? Some children will flourish and do wonderfully, and some children are not ready for this type of move, right? So these are very, very difficult questions. And even Ramban will allow those shikulim to come in, but as I say, the whole orientation has to be different. It can't just be, it's not on the radar. It has to be, I'm supposed to live here, unless there are compelling reasons, and then we discuss what the compelling reasons are. Yeah. Well, that's kind of what the Dati Lumi is saying. They interpret it that way. But as I say, the majority view of the Rambam over the centuries was he did not consider it to be a mitzvah. So there's a machlokas how to understand the Rambam. So today, the point I just wanted to illustrate was really to look at the Ramban's great love for Eretz Yisrael. And as I had mentioned, why didn't he come earlier, either Sakanat Rachim or he was needed by his community, and the good result of the disputation of Barcelona was it got him to Eretz Yisrael, and Baruch Hashem, this is where he finished his commentary on the Chumash. So next week we will finally begin in earnest, so give it a look, and most of it is not too difficult, but there's some very, very amazing remarks about Agadita, certain asides in there, about the authoritative nature of Medrash, and we will talk about that in Medrash next week. Have a good week.